Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. On behalf of the organizers, I would like to welcome you all to these public lectures on history and business in China. The public lecture series is jointly organized by the History Department and the Asia-Pacific Institute of Business of the Chinese University of Hong Kong, as well as the Public Library System of the Leisure and Cultural Services Department of the Hong Kong SAR Government. The event is made possible by a very generous donation from the Li Haisun Foundation, to which we will extend our immense gratitude. The public lecture series has presented to the Hong Kong community 6 public lectures each year since 2005 by eminent scholars from the disciplines of history, economics, and business. Our purpose is to create a platform whereby these scholars can share with the public their learned views on issues pertaining to the economy, political economy, and history of China that are of public concerns. Tonight is the second lecture of the 2 delivered by Professor Alif Derlik, but also the closing lecture of 2007. May I therefore first invite Mrs. Ho Mun-Sok Man, the Chief Librarian of the Hong Kong Central Library, to present a public library souvenir to our speaker tonight. Now I may also call upon the Professor Leung Yuen Sang, the Chairman of the History Department, to present a CHK souvenir to Professor Derlik. Now, in order to show the appreciation between the organizers, that's the History Department and the Central Library, I would like to ask Professor Leung to present a souvenir to Mrs. Ho. And Mrs. Ho will present a souvenir to Professor David Faw, the People's Representative of the History Department of Chinese University of Hong Kong. Thank you so much. As a moderator, I have a duty to introduce our speaker. But for those who were present in this theater last night, you understand that it would probably take up too much time to introduce such a distinguished scholar. And I guess you all would prefer to read the profile of Professor Derlik in the pamphlet you're holding yourself. Also, I figure as a leading scholar in cultural and critical theories, as well as Chinese studies, Professor Derlik would probably not mind if I abandon that kind of culturally hybrid ritual in a public platform in this colonial part of China, and go straight to an analogy in place of an introduction. The Chinese name of tonight's platform came from a masterpiece of history, Shi Ji, written by the grand historian Sima Qian of Han China, who lived 2,000 years ago. Sima Qian was not just an historian writing history, including business history, of his times. He was more importantly a public intellectual who, for the sake of betterment of humanity, exercised his learned intelligence to critically unfold the Chinese world problematic of the powerful and overwhelming imperial order that for the first time emerged in China. Tonight, Professor Derlik, who is also a well-known public intellectual and social critique, will similarly share with us his wisdom about the world problematic. Allow me to borrow a term created by the Club of Rome. The world problematic he is going to explore tonight is about the equally powerful an overwhelming globalization order in our own times, that for the first time China encounters and participates. I'm sure it is a deep concern for all of us sitting in this theater tonight, and we're going to listen to your wisdom. Now, may I extend our welcome to Professor Dunn.
Thank you very much, Professor So, and I'd like to thank the Department of History of Chinese University of Hong Kong for giving me this opportunity, and I'd like to thank the Hong Kong Central Library Administration for hosting us. I wish I could muster the wisdom that you attribute to me, but I'll do my best. It's always nice to try to live up to these things. I'm going to deal with contemporary issues today that usually in our field are left in the hands of political scientists. With due respect to our colleagues in political science, very often discussions of contemporary China are lacking in historical depth. And it seems to me that that the developments of the last few years in the People's Republic of China demonstrate more cogently than ever before the importance of a historical perspective in understanding where the country might be headed, at least in the eyes of the people who make the policies. And it's one of those issues that I will take up today. I'll take up a problem here that's elided in most discussions of globalization: the problem of national development under the regime of globalization. There's a suggestion in arguments for globalization that national development may be achieved through globalization, in turn contributing to further globalization and so on into the future. The suggestion goes against the tendency of these same arguments to set the global against the national as a negation of the latter. While it may not be a zero-sum relationship, the relationship between globalization and national development is nevertheless a highly disturbed one. Understood as the persistence of commitments to autonomy and sovereignty, most importantly in the realm of the economy, the national obstructs globalization, just as globalization erodes the national, at the same time rendering irrelevant any idea of development that takes such autonomy and sovereignty as its premise. If we are to take globalization seriously, in other words, the very idea of national development becomes highly problematic. On the other hand, if national development as an idea is to be taken seriously, as it was for most of the past century, then globalization appears as little more than an ideological assault on the national to rid the present of the legacies of the past. This contradiction is crucial to understanding what may seem like chronic inconsistencies in the attitudes of the PRC leadership toward development. Thus, while the party leadership has committed itself to economic policies of globalization, this commitment is tempered by concerns over issues of popular welfare, balanced development, and, most importantly, economic sovereignty, if not autonomy. These concerns are explicitly part of the developmental policies that have been enunciated over the last year under the rubric of a scientific outlook on development. In their explanations of this new approach to development, party leaders and ideologues have repeatedly referred to the necessity of learning from the policies of their predecessors, including those of Mao Zedong during the Cultural Revolution. The invocation of these earlier policies is not due simply to ideological loyalty to the past. Indeed, the imbalances in the economy that have been created by two decades of development offer prima facie evidence that what some outside observers would dismiss as ideology, past and present, does in fact indicate real concerns over real problems, so long as we take seriously the commitment to national development. While many on the inside and the outside, especially those of a neoliberal persuasion, would cast these revolutionary legacies into the proverbial trash bin of history, it's quite clear that for many in the PRC leadership, these legacies also provide a storehouse of policies that they can call upon in the resolution of problems that emerge with development, which is quite different from any kind of blind ideological loyalty to the past. As Chinese leaders seek to learn from the revolutionary past in resolving contradictions generated by rapid economic development, past discourses on development are of equal importance in understanding both their concerns and the ways in which they seek to bring the economy under control. I will discuss below some of the implications of these contradictions and consider resolutions that avoid entrapment between the past and the present, or an ideological erasure of the past by the present, but instead seek out ways to direct the forces of globalization in directions that do not erase, but rather presume the central importance of the local in globalization. I am concerned here, most importantly, with third world circumstances in globalization. I will begin with a discussion of the strategy of national development that was articulated by Chinese Marxists in the 1920s. Similar ideas were echoed subsequently in third world ideas of development, as well as in efforts to explain third world difficulties with development in such alternatives to modernization discourse as dependency theory and world system analysis. Despite differences in their diagnoses of the problems of national development, Chinese Marxist analyses were uniformly inspired by Lenin's analysis of the contradictory role imperialism played in colonial and semi-colonial countries. That while imperialism introduced into these societies the progressive forces of capitalism, it also created structural impediments to the realization of capitalist development as in Europe and North America. There were two major aspects to these impediments. One was economic. Development in these societies did not follow the logic of the national economy responding to internal demand and needs. It followed the logic of a globalizing capitalist economy and the search of imperialist powers for markets for commodities and capital. Imperialists had little or no interest in the development of these societies. What development there was did not contribute to national economic integration. An economic structure that answered various needs of the national economy, including subsistence needs of the population. It created a bifurcated economy with a modern capitalist sector increasingly integrated to a global capitalist economy, and a much larger sector that remained mired in pre-modern economic practices and was subject to the exploitative forces of the modern sector, just as the national economy as a whole was subject to the exploitative forces of global capitalism. Spatially speaking, in the case of the Chinese economy, this meant the lopsided development of coastal areas and the few coastal cities such as Shanghai, and the increasing underdevelopment of vast areas in the interior and the populations therein. Economic bifurcation also undermined efforts to achieve integration at the political level. The other aspect was social, the creation of a new class structure. As capitalism was introduced into China from the outside, the emergent Chinese bourgeoisie was a foreign product, aligned in its interests with outside forces that produced it, with little commitment to the interests of the nation as a whole. There was a distinction between a comprador bourgeoisie and a national bourgeoisie that strove for autonomy within the structural context of imperialism. but even the latter were more closely integrated structurally with the forces of global capitalism than with the national economy, and were condemned in their very activities, sort of to speak, to contribute to the deepening of the almost inevitable structural bifurcation of the economy. This was the major reason that any hope for national development had to be preceded by a social revolution that would transfer power to social forces that had an investment in the creation of a national economy, represented most importantly by the working class and the peasantry. Ultimately, as we are quite aware, this meant the creation of an autonomous state that could use political means to establish boundaries around the national economy and the basis for national economic integration, an autonomous economy that answered to internal needs, in other words. This analysis led not merely to demands for autonomy, however, but for economic autarky, as during the Cultural Revolution. In hindsight, it is clear that only through the institutionalization of state control and coercion could such autarky be achieved, which opened the way easily to the substitution of state interests in development for popular needs and aspirations. There is an additional complication, perhaps less evident in the case of a well-established society such as China than in many other Third World societies: the assumption that there already was in place a nation whose economic integrity had to be safeguarded, when the creation of an integrated national entity was itself one of the goals of economic development. The Cultural Revolution was a response to concerns that were as old as the history of the Chinese Revolution, not just the communist, but the nationalist revolution. The experience of agrarian revolution, which brought the Communist Party to power, was also an important force in shaping the course of post-revolutionary development policies, which found their clearest articulation in the Great Leap Forward of the late 1950s and the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, two events that were dynamically interlinked and represented in their day paradigmatic expressions of Third World encounters with development. To view the Cultural Revolution simply in its relationship to the history of Marxist revolutions, or in terms of a struggle between the First and Second Worlds, is insufficient. Because what imbued the Cultural Revolution with its concrete historical characteristics may be the ambiguous status of Chinese society in the 20th century, even after the victory of the Communist Party, as a society that belonged in the Second World by virtue of its socialist revolutionary history, but also in the Third World by virtue of its political, economic, and cultural relationships to the world of capitalism in Euro-America. We might keep this in mind as we listen to President Hu Jintao in Africa speaking about the commonalities between the Chinese experience and the African experience. The Cultural Revolution coincided historically with decolonization in the Third World and identified ideologically with the colonial world against both the Euro-American world of capitalism and Soviet-style social imperialism. The juxtaposition of the rural Third World against the metropolitan First and Second Worlds was important, I think, both to the new departures in Cultural Revolution socialism and to its ideological claims on the procedures of revolution. Lin Biao's Long Live the Victory of People's War in 1965 must be viewed as one of the most important documents of the Cultural Revolution, because it crystallized both the hostilities and the aspirations against the worlds of industrial capitalism and socialism of the newly emerging nations around the globe, and resonated with the ideology of national liberation struggles of which the Chinese had been the most successful to date. It matters little whether or not it was ideologically justifiable from a Marxist perspective on socialism or revolution, which was its presumed theoretical basis, though it is arguable that it carried to its logical conclusions a third worldist socialism that had appeared first in the Second Congress of the Communist International in 1920. What is relevant is that Lin applied globally a paradigm of the Chinese Revolution itself, which had captured the cities from the countryside and brought to the fore the fundamental meaning of that revolutionary experience, the primacy to any consideration of the world of agrarian against industrial societies. The hostility, unfortunately, would overshadow the more meaningful message that a resolution of global problems would require the resolution of the problems of agrarian societies, just as the resolution of economic problems in individual nations, especially the third world nations, called for the resolution of the economic problems of the majority population of peasants. The Maoist paradigm of development was possibly the most powerful of the alternative notions of development which came to the fore as the new national liberation struggles sought for ways to bolster economically their newfound political sovereignty. This paradigm proposed, A, that development policies take as their point of departure the necessity of all-round development nationally, and B, that this could be realized only by delinking from the capitalist world system, to use a term coined by Samir Amin. The first premise was enunciated clearly in Mao's classic 1956 essay on the 10 great relationships, which called for attention to contradictions created by uneven development nationally. I should note here that over the last year, this essay has once again been brought to the foreground of discussions in the People's Republic. The second premise was enunciated through the Cultural Revolution years by the stress on national self-reliance to avoid material or ideological dependence on the outside world. It followed logically from the first premise in its analytical assumption that involvement in the capitalist world system would inevitably substitute the economic demands of this world system for the needs of a national economy. These so-called Maoist premises had deep roots in the Chinese Revolution, in the intense attention of Marxists in the 1920s to the implications for the national economy of involvement in a capitalist world economy. As these premises were re-enunciated in the 1960s, they exerted immense influence in thinking on third world development, of which the work of the distinguished development economist Samir Amin may be exemplary. As important as the structural implications of this new paradigm of development were, equally important were the substantive issues it raised that resonated with contemporary concerns in both advanced capitalist or socialist and third world societies. A slogan such as self-reliance that was central to Maoist developmental ideology implied not just avoidance of dependency, but also called for active participation on the part of the people in the process of development. Its social implications were profound. Against their marginalization in earlier conceptualizations of development, capitalist or Soviet socialist, self-reliance recognized the people as both the motive force and the end of development. No longer to be left in the hands of experts, development conceived along these lines brought the people into the center stage of the developmental process. In order for such a process to work, it was necessary also to place collective values over private ones, for cooperation and everyday negotiation were crucial to the achievement of social goals. Politically, the process required participation in collective decision-making on a daily basis, creating unprecedented possibilities for grassroots democratic participation in social life. The laboring population, that's to say the majority of the people, would be responsible also for managing its own productive life. At the most fundamental level, the insistence on self-reliance was premised on a recognition of the subjectivity of the people and their ability to manage their subjectivities in accordance with social goals. In its idealistic reading, putting politics in command, a condition of self-reliance, implied the priority of public over private values. The type of individual who could live up to this absolute priority of the public over the private was obviously one who had overcome internally the force of social divisions that generated individualism, be it class and gender divisions, the division of labor, hierarchies of experts and non-experts, and at the most fundamental level, the division between mental and manual labor. Creating such individuals required the appropriate social settings, but it also required individual effort at cultural self-transformation, a necessity of the dialectic between social and cultural transformation. It required social institutions that would promote the welfare of the people and enable their loyalty to collective institutions. But it would also require individuals who, rather than take advantage of such institutions, would devote themselves to fulfilling their promises. I would like to stress here one aspect of the Maoist institutional vision that has received much criticism from the perspective of economic efficiency, but was nevertheless quite significant in its consequences for social and political organization. This was a conviction in the necessity of integrating agriculture and industry so as to overcome the structural division between the city and the countryside that seemed to characterize modern societies. This was one of the institutional innovations of the disastrous Great Leap Forward in 1958. But like other aspects of Maoist developmental thinking, its origins lie in the history of the Chinese Revolution. While the communists had sought such integration out of necessity in revolutionary Yan'an years, when they had no choice but to produce for themselves, the idea first appeared in Chinese anarchist writings in the first decade of the 20th century, inspired by the writings of Peter Kropotkin. In anarchist writing, it is also important to note, the idea of integrating industry and agriculture to create self-sufficient local communities found a parallel in the creation of well-rounded individuals who combined mental and manual labor and thus overcame the class divisions that grew out of the division of labor. For anarchists who eschewed nationalism, the primary goal was to avoid the alienation of modern industrial society in a reaffirmation of community. As it was appropriated into Maoist ideologies of development, these anarchist ideals were also linked to strategies of national autonomy and development. The idea of self-reliance, of which these institutional innovations may be viewed as expressions, is a multi-layered idea. It did not aim just at national autonomy through self-reliance, but autonomy at every level of society, down to the locality, which is what is disturbing from an economistic perspective that stresses comparative advantage. What I would like to stress here is the underlying spatial assumption of this argument, that the nation is comprised of a space defined by a bounded surface with little tolerance in that space for uneven development. For such unevenness jeopardizes not just the economic integrity, but the political existence of the nation. If the search for autarky carried the logic of national integration to its extreme, its very extremeness is a reminder that anxiety over unevenness in the national economy was a characteristic not just of extremist revolutionary regimes, but all political economic thinking that took the nation as its unit of analysis. Until the 1980s, import substitution seemed to be the preferred route to development against export-oriented development. The difference here may not be so much a difference between liberal nationalism and the revolutionary fundamentalism, but a difference in power that is embedded in the very structure of the capitalist world economy, that the powerless have very few options in their struggle for national, economic, and political integrity other than shutting out the world economy and with it the promise of development that comes at a very high social and political price. It may not be very surprising that radical social scientists have concurred that national economic development might not be possible except through some measure of delinking from the global capitalist economy dominated by nations of the first world. But shutting out the world has proven to be an impossible task. It has been made even more impossible as the controlling powers in the world economy have been prepared to use all the coercive means at their disposal to force open economies that sought to shut out a globalizing capitalism, or whenever it seemed that they might be vulnerable to dependency on others, most notoriously in the case of energy dependency, which continues to serve as an important factor in the First World's seemingly endless war against the Third. This has become even clearer in the post-Cold War period. There is something seemingly puzzling about the perpetuation by the United States and Great Britain of what used to be viewed as Cold War-era politics of continuous war. The puzzle may be a consequence of the exceptional significance attributed to communism as a factor in this war. It may be more proper in contemporary hindsight to view the Cold War as only one phase of a much longer history that has been shaped by efforts to remove all obstacles to capitalism headquartered in Great Britain and the United States in their successive hegemonies. The opening of China, first in 1842 and again in 1978, carries a symbolism that overflows the boundaries of the Cold War. The Cultural Revolution seems irrelevant today. The problems it addressed no longer significant. In its day, it appeared as a breakthrough in the history of socialist revolutions or revolutions in general, in defiance of the inevitability of de-radicalization. At a time when socialism and the idea of revolution have been relegated to the past, a breakthrough in revolutionary politics carries little meaning, let alone historical significance. Much the same could be said with regard to the Cultural Revolution as an expression of resurgent Third World politics. In the immediate circumstances of the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s, the idea of a Third World carried significant weight in global political discourse. In our day, when it is hardly possible to speak of the Third World as a coherent idea, let alone a promise, it makes little sense to speak of a revolutionary Third World alternative to accepted paradigms of development. These changes are products of transformations in global relations. The history of socialism as we have known it, no less than the history of the Third World, needs to be comprehended in its relationship to transformations within capitalism. Colonialism and socialism as a response to it, especially in the Third World, were products of one phase within capitalism. While capitalism as a mode of production persists, contemporary capitalism is quite different in the global relations it calls for than the capitalism that produced the Third World or sought to contain the socialism that was its own product. This new phase in capitalism, whether it's called global capitalism, late capitalism, post-Fordism, or flexible production, has made irrelevant earlier conceptualizations of global relations as well as of the relations of exploitation and oppression informed by those conceptualizations. Euro-American transnational corporations may still be dominant globally, but they have been joined by others, some of them originating in the former Third World. There may still be dominant nations, but it makes less sense than before to speak of imperialism or colonialism when the nation-state has lost much of its power to corporations that are transnational, both in personnel and culture. And most importantly, in the context of this discussion, it makes little sense to speak of national economic autonomy when the paradigm of development based on the national market has been replaced by a paradigm of development that calls for export economies and porous national boundaries as a condition of development. The nation state, indispensable to the economic operations of capital in an earlier stage, now finds itself under attack as an obstacle to the same operations. Capital still rules, but under a different regime, one that seeks to be inclusive rather than exclusive. States still exist, more powerfully than ever, but with more tenuous ties to the nation. The distinction between the inside and the outside, too, has become more tenuous. These structural transformations within capitalism were to produce their own cultural revolution, which is now encapsulated by the term postmodernism. This other cultural revolution, a cultural revolution of capitalism, coincided with the Chinese Cultural Revolution, although few were aware at the time of its eventual significance. It may be interesting to recall in historical hindsight that the launching of the Cultural Revolution in China coincided almost to the year with the establishment of the export zones in Kaohsiung in Taiwan and Masan in South Korea. It might not have occurred to radical critics of modernization and capitalism at the time that the future lay with the latter than the former. But that is exactly what has happened. Stress on national autonomy in economic development has receded before the onslaught of export-oriented economies symbolized by these zones. The success of these economic zones, needless to say, would be made possible ultimately by new technologies that enabled the transnationalization of production. It was these same technologies that would make possible the new Cultural Revolution in capitalism, central to which is its self-representation as producer of images and information rather than of commodities, which still need to be produced, albeit in third world locations, while the first world takes over as the brain center in designing the world. What the capitalist Cultural Revolution produced ideologically was culture commodified and rendered into an end in itself, infinitely malleable and marketable, rather than culture as a means to something else, such as a community. Viewed in this perspective, what is striking about the Cultural Revolution in China was that it was directed at the problems of a world that was already being replaced by another world dictated by the transformative powers of contemporary capitalism that was far ahead of what its critics imagined, whether they were located in the first, second, or the third worlds. As product of the revolution against imperialism or first world domination of the third world, the Cultural Revolution spoke to problems inherited from the past, when capitalism was already in the process of creating new global relations that made those problems irrelevant. The contradictions between modernism and anti-modernism in Mao Zedong thought at the moment of their enunciation were already incorporated in postmodernist conceptualization of the world, which since then have proven to be of immense capacity in their ability to contain contradictions, so that business can utilize Maoist strategies in planning for the market, while radicals continue to argue about appropriate responses to cliché-ridden conceptions of capitalism. Whatever its failings as ideology and practice, the demise of Maoism as it appeared during the Cultural Revolution was a result not just of its own failings as a revolutionary ideology, but of its increasing irrelevance to an emergent world of capitalism that was radically different than the one that had produced Maoism. Cultural Revolution Maoism represented not a solution for the future, as it was taken to be at the time, but a last gasp of a past that was already irrelevant to a present that had overtaken it. In the first of a three-volume study of contemporary global transformations, the rise of the network society, Manuel Castells has offered a revealing analysis of the re-spatialization of the political economy of development, both as concept and as practice. His theorization of the new situation of globality is important not because what he has to say is particularly unusual, but because he is able, through the metaphor of the network society, to synthesize much that has been written on the question of globalization. His work is particularly relevant to my argument here because a spatialization of the global capitalist economy around nodes in a network provides a cogent contrast to the spatialization around bounded surfaces that I discussed above. It may or may not describe accurately the processes at work in the contemporary world economy, but it has much to say about the shift in ways of thinking about the world economy that has taken place over the last two decades. One of the most impressive aspects of Castells' analysis is its ability to account for an intensified mobility of capital while retaining a strong sense of the persistence of structural relationships in power. Castells' metaphor of networks in the description of contemporary capitalism is derived from the central importance he assigns to information technologies, which then serve as the paradigm for the reconfiguration of global relations. The metaphor of network offers ways of envisaging the new global capitalism in both its unities and disunities, in its pervasiveness, as well as in the huge gaps that are systemic products of the global economy. The metaphor of network shifts attention from surfaces to highways that link nodes in the global economy. A network has no boundaries of any permanence, but may expand or contract at a moment's notice and shift in its internal configurations as its nodes move from one location to another. Marginality to the global economy may mean being outside of the network as well as in the many spaces within that are in its many gaps. Marginality does not imply being untouched by the networks, as the inductive effects of network flows affect even those who are not direct participants in its many flows. Finally, the network metaphor offers new ways of accounting for power. It's possible to state that the most powerful nodes in the global economy may be those locations where nodes of economic, political, and cultural power coincide. The network militates against neat spatialities, but it also allows for their inclusion in considerations of power. While any location may be included in the network, the most powerful and controlling nodes are still located in the national spaces of commanding global presence. Castells identifies North America, Europe, and East Asia as the locations of such commanding power that determine the, quote, the basic architecture of global relations. Within this visible architecture, however, quote again, there are dynamic processes of competition and change that infuse a variable geometry into a global system of economic processes, end of quote. As he explains it, again, there's a long quote here, what I call the newest international division of labor is constructed around four different positions in the informational global economy. The producers of high value based on informational labor. The producers of high volume based on lower cost labor. The producers of raw materials based on natural endowments. And the redundant producers reduced to devalued labor. The critical matter is that these different positions do not coincide with countries. They are organized in networks and flows using the technological infrastructure of the informational economy. They feature geographic concentrations in some areas of the planet so that the global economy is not geographically undifferentiated. Yet the newest international division of labor does not take place between countries, but between economic agents placed in the four positions that I have indicated along a global structure of networks and flows. Castells has less to say about the organizational aspects of such structurations. On the alternative specializations produced, for instance, by transnational corporations, as well as a host of transnational organizations, from NGOs to universities. His analysis is, nevertheless, at one with most other analyses of globalization that are premised on the insufficiency of the nation as a unit of analysis in the analysis of contemporary global economy. While to an analyst such as Castells, this may present a problem where the social, political, and cultural implications of globalization are concerned, ideologues of global capitalism perceive in it the end of the nation state and the need to re-spatialize politics to conform to the essential borderlessness of a globalized economy. One such analyst is Ken Ichiomai, who suggests that, quote, the nation state has become an unnatural, even a dysfunctional organizational unit for thinking about economic activity, end of quote. The alternative is to rethink political units in terms of region states that correspond to the regional economies that are on the emergence with globalization, that also correspond, we might note, to the more stable nodes in the global networks. What Omaya proposes for China, which plays a large part in his analysis, provides a sharp contrast to the economic thinking of Chinese Marxists that I described above. I quote, the people of Guangzhou know that they cannot deny a significant ongoing relationship with the rest of mainland China. That connection is real and is part of their strength and appeal. What they cannot afford is to be victims of tight centralized control. But they can productively be, in fact, they would do well to be, part of a loose grouping of Chinese regional states, a kind of Chinese federation or commonwealth. Unfortunately, Omaya has little to say on what the mutual responsibility would be of the region states in such a federation, or what role the central government would play in enforcing those responsibilities. We may glean what he has in mind, however, from his discussion of what he calls the civil minimum, the provision of equal services, including those that entail subsistence needs to all the citizens of the nation state, which, in his view, is inconsistent with the efficient allocation of resources. As he puts it, alignment of government power with domestic special interests and have-not regions makes it virtually impossible for those at the center to adopt responsible policies for the nation as a whole, let alone for its participation in the wider borderless economy. No matter how understandable the political or even social pressures behind these alignments, they make no sense economically. Investing money inefficiently never does. In a borderless world where economic interdependence creates ever higher degrees of sensitivity to other economies, it is inherently unsustainable. Omaya does not tell the reader what an explicit commitment to heightened regional autonomy within a Commonwealth of China might leave of a Commonwealth of China when the regional economy acts or aspires to act as, quote, as a local outpost of the global economy, end of quote. The message, however, is clear. Globalization means the supremacy of the market in shaping all relations, social and political, and the nation state and its social and political concerns is an impediment to the efficient functioning of the market. The nation state must allow the regional autonomy that permits successful regions to participate in the global economy, unhampered by obligations to other parts or constituencies of the nation guaranteed earlier by the state. What he does not say is why the nation state might be needed at all under the circumstances, except to guarantee the success of its global nodes in the global economy, and perhaps to suppress the dissent that might result from its own participation in the bifurcation of the economy. The state here becomes something more than a mere promoter of economic development. It appears as an enforcer of the interests of the local outposts of the global economy, and, we might add, of those in charge of local outposts. This is the state of global capitalism. At a time when the nation no longer serves as an exclusive or even a viable unit of economic activity, when the ties between the state and the nation are once again being blurred, what is in question is not merely the viability of the nation state, but the more substantial question of the relationship between forms of political governance and public welfare. Delinking from the world economy is no longer an option. Neither is revolutions understood as systemic transformations. Revolutions, as we have known them, have been products of the project of modernity with nation states as their premise. The question of governance presently has to take as its point of departure contemporary political configurations, which are difficult to grasp in terms of these earlier paradigms of politics. It has become painfully evident over the past decade that unevenness of power has assumed greater sharpness than ever before with the expansion of the coercive power of the United States, to the point where globalization appears to many to be little more than the universalization of United States imperialism. The problem with an analysis such as Omaya's is its obliviousness to the different consequences of marketization in different social and political contexts. Most importantly, in the differences between those societies who occupy the architectural centers of global power, as Castells puts it, and those who are powerless or marginal. Unevenness applies not just to political relations between countries, but to social relations within countries. Paralleling inequality between countries, in other words, are inequalities in class and gender relationships that cut across countries and are in the process of being globalized as well. Equally problematic is the rather cavalier dismissal in such an analysis of the surpluses implied by national development. In 1987, then Premier Zhao Ziyang suggested that all of coastal China be converted into a special economic zone to encourage foreign investment. While coastal China has not become a special economic zone, it has developed rapidly over the last decade and a half, producing that economic bifurcation which earlier revolutionary nationalists had feared. Indeed, analysts such as Dean Forbes have perceived in the development of Southeast and East Asian economies of an urban corridor, increasingly remote from its hinterland. The problem is what meaning to assign to this restructuring of national economies into networks that cut across national boundaries. There is a difference between a city-state such as Singapore or Hong Kong and a continental nation such as the People's Republic of China in judging the consequences of an urban corridor that unites them. The latter has to face the politically divisive consequences of a structural bifurcation in the national economy, which presents questions not only of national sovereignty, but the very viability of the nation that are not likely to go away so long as nations exist, which is also an empirical fact. The PRC government, with a century of nationalist socialist revolution behind it, has so far refused to accept the bifurcation of the economy and has made some effort, at least, to promote the development of Western China. Whether it will be successful in the effort remains to be seen. The rapidly developing parts of the economy in the urban corridor are not without deep problems either. There is little need here to dwell upon the ecological destructiveness of rapid growth facilitated by foreign investment, by investors who have little interest in the ecological welfare of places where they invest. Likewise, the exploitation of labor has reached levels where slave-like or even slave labor has made a comeback. Recent studies by Anita Chan and Pun Gai document the horrendous condition of Chinese labor in the most rapidly developing areas. Labor not only does not receive much help from the state, but suffers from the oppressive collaboration between local officials and foreign investors. The situation is obviously worse in the so-called developing economies, but similar phenomena are by no means absent from the most developed economies, such as the United States. These problems call for difficult decisions. I can only suggest here some considerations that are crucial to any contemporary cultural transformation or even a cultural revolution that should be a point of departure in confronting the seemingly intractable problems we confront. First is the ideology of development itself, developmentalism, that has become something of a global faith driven by corporate and government greed, but also by a globalized cultural desire to participate in endless cycles of consumption. Second is attention to places, concrete locations of everyday life, which, rather than meaningless statistics of growth at the national or state level, ought to be the measure of economic health, social welfare, and political democracy. This also requires reconsideration of governance at all levels, beginning with places, and guaranteed public participation not only in the political process, but in corporate decision-making as well. Finally, if globalization is to serve as more than an excuse for uncontrolled exploitation of labor globally, it must be accompanied by a cultivation of global responsibility on the part of global actors, that a corporation, say, should be responsible not only to its stockholders or the nation or location from which it hails, but to every location where it conducts its activities. The repudiation of Maoist alternatives in modernity is part of an overall repudiation of radical alternatives to capitalism. While transformations in capitalism may have rendered irrelevant earlier socialist challenges to its domination, however, capitalism is still capitalism. And these same transformations have produced and are in the process of producing problems that await urgent resolution. Some of these problems are as old as the history of capitalism. Others are products of new departures in capitalist production and organization. The resolution of these problems must take the present as their point of departure. But that's not to say that the past does not have anything to offer to the present. Recalling earlier revolutionary challenges is necessary to overcoming the ideological hegemony of capital. But it is not only for ideological reasons that the past is important. The revolutionary Maoist vision of society in particular, what I described above is the substantive issues that Maoism raised with regard to local society, may be relevant in surprising ways to confronting problems of contemporary capitalism. This may explain why, despite persistent anxiety over the disorders of the past and celebration of the success of the reforms, Maoist assumptions concerning comprehensive and autonomous national development resist ideological efforts to erase them. Indeed, they continue to serve, if only implicitly, as an important measure of national welfare and the long-term success of development policies. Whether those assumptions can be translated into a set of policies appropriate to present-day China remains to be seen. In the meantime, it's the persistence of those assumptions that has given Chinese development its particular characteristics, leading to renewed assertions of a Chinese model of development or Beijing consensus, this time within the context of globalization. If I may just add here a word to this, that for those of you who may not keep up with what goes on in Beijing these days, but over the last year, under the rubric of this Kezhe Fajangwan Scientific Development Outlook, that this idea of comprehensive development across the national surfaces has once again been brought back, along with the assertion that human beings are the beginning and the end of all development. What that will add up to in practice, I guess, remains to be seen for all of us. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much. Now, open to the floor. It's a lot of very challenging ideas. Oh, yes, actually, you can be in charge. I pretend to be in charge. You're the de facto. Just go ahead.
Yes, Professor Durley, thank you for a very interesting lecture. Great question I'd like to put to you is that as we globalize, governments have actually been collecting a lot more tax. What do the globalization theories say about governments in that sort of position? Because when governments gather tax, they put the money into armaments. And that doesn't lead to a more global society. It leads to protected society within their own spheres.
What do theorists of globalization say about that? The ones who speak to those things are people who share my views. You would call them people on the left, sort of to speak, who are not proponents but critics of globalization, who do not agree that the state is in the process of disappearing, and in fact that the state is evidenced by measures such as taxation. And I would add to it the supervisory role played by the state, the state interference in society is becoming more powerful than ever before. That this is very much a characteristic of the contemporary state. And what is different is that the state, instead of representing the interests of the population becomes the enforcer of order at the global level for the conduct of the free market. And as you know, David, that the notion of states staying out of the market has always been something of a myth, but in fact states have played that role of creating markets and guaranteeing their functioning. And I think that's what they are doing right now. I'm not sure that presents itself as a contradiction. I have argued that the term globalization itself is ideological because it refers to a space it refers to the whole globe, whereas what we call globalization in its realities refers to only limited parts of the globe. And I think it is that the states have been very important in defining what those limited parts of the globe are. Thank you. And hence,
one,
you know,
and
I mean,
two. First, second.
The test becomes then, how to make states responsible to populations once again, rather than these off-ground corporations or whatever.
Professor Dennis, thank you very much for,
yes, ma'am.
For your inspiring lecture. I'm very interested in your last remark about the scientific development.
Scientific development outlook?
Yes. Now in Beijing, would you enlighten us a little bit more of what is this about and what impact and significant is it in China or in Beijing now?
Thank you. Well, the term has existed, I guess, for 2 years now. That and associated with the Hu Jintao most closely. It is the new leadership's take on development, which represents a reconsideration of the developmental policies of the last three decades. If I could, at the risk of boring some of you, who I'm sure are familiar with these things, I will use a periodization that's offered by Lin Chun in this new book on contemporary Chinese socialism. She argues that we have now entered the third phase of reform. That the first phase corresponding to Deng Xiaoping's reforms of the 1980s, and then the second phase in the 1990s after 1992. To the early part of this century, associated most closely with the name of Jiang Zemin, and the difference being is that in the first phase there was some uncertainty, so there was a strong socialist legacy, there was a hesitant opening up, but socialism was still very much the issue, but then in the second phase an almost total abandonment of the socialist legacies of the past, and that's attributed to Jiang Zemin. And now Lin Chun and many people in China think that the country is entering a third phase of reform, which is a reconsideration, a reevaluation of the preceding phases, and making up for their deficiencies. And these deficiencies are all across the board, but it's interesting that the first item in the program of this scientific development outlook, the first item is the insistence on human beings, that human beings are the beginning, the point of departure for reform and for development. And that development should take human beings as their goal. And the second one is this comprehensive and balanced development business, which is very important. Of course, they have spoken of the business of, central and western China falling behind the coastal areas they have been talking about for some years. But now that's receiving more serious attention. I was there. I was talking to Professor Wang Xiaoguan at Chinese U, since he analyzes these things very closely and keeps up with them. And Professor Wang thinks that that there are actually some improvements that are becoming visible. It's in rural China, especially in areas of public health, public welfare, education, etc. Whether or not they will continue, it remains to be seen. But most people that I am familiar with have a great deal of confidence in the Hu Jintao's and the commitment to these ideas. And this is very interesting. This I should actually say that this talk I gave last August. I was in the I was a visiting professor in the Zhongyan Bianyiju, the Central Compilation and Translation Bureau. And I was asked to give a public lecture as part of my residence there, and I gave it. And it led to a very lively discussion. I mean, you know, I was a little concerned referring to Lin Biao and Mao Zedong and all that. But there were many people who actually respond to this kind of thing, that the past should not be completely abandoned. It's not to be imitated, but nevertheless, that it may serve as an inspiration for the present, that the history of the revolution, the socialist legacies, provide a reservoir of values that may be very important in coping with contemporary problems. It's a very open question. You don't know what to do with it. The text, the outlining this scientific development outlook, I was discussing it last week in another context, and it's a. You look at the text. You can almost see in the text an effort to balance all kinds of interests. To take the first one, for instance, the human beings being the point of departure and the end of development. It's very interesting that there was a debate last summer about this. You know, Ren, you know, human. I'm using Ren, human for Ren. Whether Ren refers to everybody, or Ren means Renmin, because if it means Renmin, you know, it's a sort of class interpretation of Ren, because Renmin, as usual, is the peasants and the workers. Whereas if you say Ren, it includes everybody. So it's nice to have these words there, but the words themselves are still subject to controversy. And one of the other things, of course, the other items that was of great deal of interest, and about which there have been some measures, is the emphasis on what's called an ecological civilization. Shengtai Wenming is a new term that they are using, which is very nice. I mean, some measures are there, but in the midst of all this, the text nevertheless reaffirms over and over and over again that development is primary. So there is a fundamental technological element there that still shows certain kinds of commitments. But it's a very interesting development. People are talking about it, and by this time the politics of the Communist Party is so complicated. It has always been complicated, but now there are people who are actually committed to a neoliberal economy. I mean, there are people in the party who want to pursue these things, regardless of what happens in Western China or Central China, etc. Just like Kenichi Omae. Yeah, I mean, you know, there are people who listen to Kenichi Omae that China should go with. In other words, by this time, there's a group of people who have a class interest in certain kind of development. Because you are well aware that according to statistics published by Chinese sociologists, that the division of wealth, the distribution of wealth in China is has reached levels of inequality that are comparable to the United States, that in the distribution of wealth. So there is, you know, there is an effort to confront these things, but whether or not the people who advocate these, including President Hu, have the power to pursue them to fulfillment is another kind of question.
Thank you. This gentleman and then the lady and the gentleman on the second floor.
Thank you. And I have to beg your pardon for coming late, but I really have to thank Professor Paul for throwing in the stepping stone that we can further the quest for global governance. Right. Now, in the first instance, I think I should bring in the three perspectives in the Western political philosophy in terms of government. Government, right. Government, yes. Now, the first one is Hobbesian.
This person is what?
Hobbesian. And his objective, the goal is sovereignty, right? The second one, Concentrate in terms of judgment, in the architectonics of making decisions, all right? Or in the spatial, temporal, virtuality. Now, the third one is most important, which I want to stress to correspond with Professor Ford's quest, is the Grotian or the jurisprudential attitude or distribution of power, right? Let's just, I was, my last remark, saying the hierarchical structure in a state. Now, there are two different type. One is the administration of the law or the administrative power under so-called quasi-judicial powers, including all the courts and all the government and monopoly and everything else, right? Now, under that, the apparatus or the internal administration of law is using quasi-judicial powers. Now, I've confirmed with A.G. Thomas in another term which is called spreading to extraterritoriality in what I call pseudo-judicial powers, like international decrees, like the UN Charter, like the ILO, like constitutions, like basic laws in Hong Kong. See?
Excuse me, can you wrap your question in 1 minute?
Now, we should at least understand the hierarchical structure before we can deal with, like Professor Ward's quest into taxation. See? Now, the thing is, after we understand all that, now, we are talking about political economy as the Marxian strand, right? They're always saying, you are facing the aging of advanced economy. Now, Marx exploited actually from Hegelian viewpoint, right? But then he was right. In the aging advanced economy, like Professor Peter Berger, he's coined another term, the capitalistic revolution, which is what we are facing now, what we call postmodern world, like the new left in France, like Jean-François Lyotard, the postmodern condition, the condition postmodern, and the Marxian transform into the constructivism. See? That's the whole story of the ideas, right?
Thank you.
I suppose I agree. you said the word is hierarchy. I agree.
Yes, please.
Yes. Good evening, Professor. And so may I ask you your ideas about the environmental sustainability in China in view of globalization, and also the keeping of nuclear weapons by China and by its neighboring countries, and also maybe North Korea, Japan, Pakistan, or India, or so on and so forth, or France, etc. Yes, your ideas. Yeah, environmental sustainability. Thank you.
Well, the Chinese leadership admits that as things are going now, China faces an environmental disaster. So, thank you for asking that, because when I was answering Inha's question, part of this scientific outlook, scientific development outlook, actually states that the economy should be rendered more sustainable. Once again, whether or not it's in the program, but whether or not this will be possible, whether or not they'll be able to enforce it, is another kind of question. As for the nuclear weapons, I don't think anybody should have nuclear weapons. I mean, if that's the question I'm trying to figure out, I think, I don't think anybody should have nuclear weapons, including the United States. But I think, once again, the United States is being very hypocritical and using the excuse of nuclear weapons to bully other people. Now, North Korea is perhaps a strange leadership to deal with, but let's not forget that the United States is doing this with Iran as well. And in all of these cases, the so-called nuclear threat from these countries is so remote as compared to the power commanded by the United States and others who already have the nuclear power, what the U.S. leadership says on these things is hardly credible to me. I don't think any of them should have it. But there's no reason why the United States should have it and deny it to others, especially those people. You know, if North Korea has one bomb, what are they going to do with it? Iran isn't even close. You are aiming at the future. I'm afraid it must be viewed nothing as a diplomatic excuse against countries that the United States does not approve of. And I think it really goes with some of this stuff. But I was saying that, for years during the Cold War, you say communism was the problem. The United States, as Great Britain back in the 18th and 19th century, if you will recall the treaties signed between the Qing and Great Britain, it was always that they cannot be allowed to close their doors to civilization, which meant they cannot be allowed to close their doors to commerce. The United States right now has taken this over, and the United States is intolerant of any country that tries to establish some measure of economic sovereignty to deal with internal needs. And, of course, China is one of them. That's why there's this constant complaint that the Chinese are not living up to the WTO goals, that the Chinese are not being globalizing fast enough, whatever. And it's really very interesting. To me, it has always been very puzzling that you even have, respectable economists of China participate in this kind of conversation that they talk about China, they should devalue the renminbi and this and that. That they never talk about that. According to some statistics I recall, 53% of U.S. Imports into the United States from China are internal corporate imports. In other words, U.S. corporations that are producing in China are then importing those goods into the United States. And nobody talks about this, that the role played by American corporations in all these transactions. And so is China against the United States. So I think that we really have to be careful about the misuse of all of these, from trade inequalities to these issues of nuclear weapons that you speak of. Again, the latest example about, whether or not China exploded one of those satellites out in space. It seems like China is starting an arms race. Now, this is really very interesting. There are many U.S.-China scholars who talk like that.
the China threat. There was an editorial in the South China Morning Post this morning by somebody of Chinese origin who apparently teaches in the U.S. Naval Academy, and talking about the China threat. That in other words, if anybody nudges against U.S. hegemony in the world, that country becomes a threat to world peace. Whereas from all the evidence we have, it's really the United States that's the greatest threat to world peace. Since World War II, the United States has been at war in more places than any other country. But this is really a fascinating kind of thing. There's a new book by James Peck on U.S. Policy toward China since World War II that I would recommend to everybody. It's called U.S. Policy toward China and the Origins of American Globalism. Always finding an excuse with other people to put them down. And I think that this is becoming I would like to draw a distinction between the Gramscian distinction between domination and hegemony. The United States is losing its hegemony. It's not like in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s that many people around the world look to the United States, American way of life, you know, that's going that way. The United States is losing. So that the domination is beginning to take precedence over the hegemony. As people around the world become more critical of the United States. In other words, to speak in everyday language, the United States is losing respect among people around the world. And the response is more force, it's more domination, and more aggressiveness, which I think is really very dangerous for the whole world as well as for the United States.
Good
evening, Professor. From your very insightful lecture, there was when you said that globalization would bring on a realignment of states according to regional in economic positions, according to their economic alignment. My question is that since the establishment of nation states, the notion of national culture has been used to bind these nation states. And you might agree if I say that it's more of a tool used by political forces to keep these nation states intact rather than natural culture. When you talk of these new realignments according to regional economic positions, do you not think that these same political forces would devise newer methods to cling on to this current status quo? Or do you think that the power of globalization is strong enough to undo any such attempt to cling on to either hegemony or whatever word you wish to use for these political forces to keep the status quo intact? Thank you.
Well, I think this question came up a little bit yesterday also. I think both are happening. In other words, there's a struggle going on right now. The struggle is more obvious in some places than in other places. I think there are anxieties, deep anxieties, in the People's Republic of China about the emergence of regional cultures, the re-emergence of regional cultures which becomes very evident in references to places like Taiwan and Hong Kong and everything. But I think it applies to other places as well, how to strengthen a culture. Some of you will be more familiar with this than I, even the emergence of regional languages, not just the spoken language, but the written language, right? The new dictionaries of Cantonese and Taiwanese. There's a new dictionary of Taiwanese that's coming out. But I believe I was talking to a colleague, Victor Mayer, and there was a Dictionary of Cantonese that was suppressed as far as, is that correct? At least that's what I was told. In other words, you know.
And it's not in Hong Kong.
The what?
No, it's not in Hong Kong.
It is still in Hong Kong, but there is definitely this kind of fear. In other words, what I'm saying is that the fear is there with regard to so-called ethnic minorities. But it's the fear is there even for the Han populations. But if we take a place where these things become more overt, like in the United States, there is a definite struggle that has been going on since the 1980s, that has been dubbed the culture wars. I don't know if you're familiar with that. You know, I don't know where anybody is from, but the so-called culture wars. Refer to efforts to include people in U.S. textbooks, let's say, U.S. history textbooks, people who had been excluded from them. That includes women, but also ethnic groups of various kinds, Amerindians, etc., that, you know, to bring them all into American history. And all of a sudden, there was this hullabaloo, and this started under Ronald Reagan's years. And in the 1980s, the head of the National Institute for the Humanities was actually Vice President Cheney's wife, Lynn Cheney, was the head of that. So there is a struggle going back to those years of what is going to be American culture. You know, the same Samuel Huntington who talked about the clash of civilizations has jumped into the fray to talk about how the U.S. is being destroyed because of migration from Mexico. That a new Catholic element is coming into American society. That's going to be the end of the United States. So I think that this struggle is going on more overtly in some places than in other places. I don't know if, we have so many processes at work that we need to sort out analytically before we even get to worry about what might happen in the future. Because there is definitely, the universalization of consumer culture. I was walking here from my hotel tonight and I look at the streets and I was thinking of what we are going to be talking about in this room. And I said, you know, you feel very depressed that are we just a bunch of academics talking to one another about this? Everybody out there is going crazy with consumption. I mean, you can hardly walk on the street. And here we are talking about, you know, revival of Maoism, this. and of course, that was my answer to my Chinese friends in Beijing. They are talking about, you know, reviving socialism. I say, have you guys looked out the window? What's going on the streets there? Everybody's going crazy. You know, buy, buy, buy. Even the government has signs, posters saying consume so that the economy advances. And then they turn around and say we're going to be socialist. So we are caught up in this. But there is the universalization of consumption. As I was saying last night, there is the universalization of the social sciences in many ways, despite all the thing about different ways of knowing, etc. These there. On the other hand, we also have these fragmentations going on, both at the national and the global level. These are all happening at the same time. And I would hardly venture a prediction of any kind. I don't see where this is going to end in the near future. And by that time, as I said, there are other problems that are coming at us that we need to worry about.
According to my watch, I should stop right now. But since this is the last and concluding lecture, probably we let one more person to ask. And I think that gentleman right up there is already waiting for a long, long time. And I know that there are other people who want to raise the question, but I'm sorry that we have to finish on time. So this will be the last one, and please make it very quick, very short.
What do you think about the labor union development in China? Because someone think that labor union in China, the potential of labor union development in China is limited because of historical factor. They are under the strict control of Chinese Communist Party in the long, long time period. Okay, that's all.
Thank you.
Once again, at least at the level of talk, there is some talk that that independent labor unions may come in handy, and there was some support given to the union activities against Walmart and all that, but would the government let the unionism really advance to the point where labor unions can become an independent force? Again, here I speak as an amateur. I'm not a historian of labor unions in China, but I don't think so. I don't think so. I think the control of labor is very important for the developmental policies of the government. And to me, it's one of the saddest things that that in a way. The government has over the years used socialism as an excuse to keep labor union activities down and in some ways participate in the exploitation of the labor for the development of the nation. That's all.
Thank you very much for the very thought-provoking talk and also the all the answers you give us. Again, thank you so much. And thank you for the audience. See you again next year.